This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website. And Brexit, Trump, pah. Markets don't care. The Dow smashed 21,000. The FTSE hit another record high. When will the bull run out of steam?
In the classic Sir John Templeton model of bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on scepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria, are we seeing euphoria?
The pound's continued to fall, though so too the optimism of savers after being warned to expect woefully low rates for another 2 years. Who says so? Well, Star Fund manager Neil Woodford, someone who hobnobbed with our very own Simon recently. I hear he's not stopped talking about it, Simon. Also today, the team run the rule over next week's budget. How will it impact that pound in your pocket? One feature of last year's Red Box outing, the Lifetime ISA, is due to come in next month.
If you want to draw it out before age 60 and not buy a property with it, you don't get the government bonus, the 25% government bonus, and there's a 5% penalty.
But it's run into a spot of bother, in that you may actually struggle to find anywhere that offers it. Also, we talk death and taxes, namely the huge rise in probate fees coming in soon, and could our car insurance premiums be set to soar?
What this comes down to is the insurance industry, of course, are very upset about this, and it will have an impact on prices.
We also watch Simon turn puce as we talk unfair parking fines, and me get equally irate at the idea of a vegetarian Chelsea tractor for the girls. What will get Lee going today, I wonder. But first, Simon, Lee, it's been a glorious 2.25 years. You've been coming into my studio each week, sharing your eminent financial knowledge. Oh, what laughs, what fun we've had. But that's what we think. It's time to ask the people that count. So we're running a little survey to find out what you think of our This Is Money show. What do you think of the format? What sort of topics would you like us to cover? Now, it'll only take about 5 minutes and you could win a brand new Pure DAB radio as our way of saying thank you. Just go to our Twitter or Facebook page for details. But it got me thinking, what was the most memorable moment in that 28 months of broadcasting for you? Just to give you some idea, lads, this is one of mine, and there are many.
The food stuff I'm most looking forward to trying this morning is the turkey, because as is traditional in this test, it's not real turkey, is it? It's not real turkey, is it? It's turkey ham, isn't it?
And if you're lucky, Simon.
I'm hoping to guide any of our listeners out there who are going to be eating turkey ham at Christmas lunch as to which one is the best.
Just a little taster of some of our Christmas taste tests there, Simon. I couldn't pick all of them, so I had to pick that clip. But for you, Simon, a memorable moment.
Well, I believe that one of my memorable moments has also been stolen with the warm bath of homicide comment.
That's coming up.
However, I think that if I was going to pick out one very memorable moment, it would probably be the morning that we were sat here after the Brexit vote. When obviously something fairly substantial had just happened and everybody was trying to pick apart what on earth had just gone on. And that was a very interesting day. It was a very interesting morning. And I'd been into the office early, watched the stock market take an absolute tumble on opening, gain a bit more ground, David Cameron resign. And then we were in here trying to unpick what it all meant for us. I don't know. Are we even any clearer now what it all means for us? I'm not so sure.
Lee, for you?
Oh, George, there's too many to mention. We've had some right laughs, haven't we, over the years?
I think, indeed.
You know, the Christmas taste test is always an absolute... I look forward to Christmas just as much as for the taste test these days, even though you're terrible Brussels sprout cooking. But do you know what, Simon stole what I was going to say? That morning when we came in, the Brexit vote, I'd had hardly any sleep, woke up, see what was happening, got a train into London. We came here, it was like a complete whirlwind. That was real broadcasting, I think, like excitement. Do you know what I mean? It was all breaking around us, and it's a very memorable moment. And I will always remember Brexit, that day it happened, us going into the radio.
I will also remember that, but I'll leave you with this instead. Sight and money section of the Mail Online. Customers, I'm sorry.
a warm bath of homicide.
There's nothing wrong with a warm bath of homicide. You can relax.
I just completely lost it. We're talking about warm baths. Customers of the so-called Big Six energy suppliers could be playing like a pro at the end there. I pulled it back together. Oh, it gets me going every time.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
Simon, just to be clear, what on earth were you talking about there?
I was talking about why I love Midsummer Murders. Yeah. It's one of my favourite, it's one of my guilty pleasures, one of my favourite TV programmes. And I love to settle down to watch a Midsummer Murders with a glass of wine. And I said that it was like a warm bath of homicide.
Yeah. So just to repeat, we'd love to know your thoughts about the This Is Money show. Go to our Twitter or Facebook page and tell us more. Bit more of that? Yes, please. Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. That voice you were hearing, editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce are with me to round up the week's top stories they've been covering. And coming up, we go crystal ball gazing at what the Chancellor may have in store for us in his first and last spring budget. But first, another big event due to take place this month. I'm talking about the triggering of Article 50. But despite Brexit, despite the election of Donald Trump, events that we were told would be an absolute nightmare for the markets. Well, the Dow Jones smashed 21,000. The FTSE hit a new record high this week. Now, it's risen a third since February last year, adding over £30 billion to the value of the stock market's biggest companies. Now, it's left commentators asking, could it break the 10,000 barrier? But the pound continues to sink.
I mean, that has been a fairly standard reaction from the stock market since last June, has been pound down, stock market up. And we've heard talk of Trump bump, the President of the United States being, frankly, a little bit more emollient, more statesmanlike, dare one say. And also, there was some decent UK economic data, which shouldn't necessarily be sniffed at. The mortgage numbers, they were fine. The manufacturing sentiment indicator was fine. And Europe, of course, is our individual single biggest trading partner, for the moment at least. And there, again, the economic data coming out looked pretty encouraging. I mean, what's intriguing is that in the first, I think it was 41 trading days of the year to the end of February, the FTSE 100 was up 1.6%. That's exactly what it's achieved today. So it's doubled that in the space of one trading day. I think what intrigued us was that it'd been uncannily calm the first 2 months of the year. We'd actually only had one day when the market, the FTSE 100, had gone up or down by more than 1% from open to close in 41. And that compares to an average since 1995 of once every 5 days. So we've looked back to 1995 just to see, however, the many similar eerily quiet starts we've had to the year. And 95, 96, 04, 05, 06 and 14 have all seen 5 1% movements or less. Only 2005 has actually seen just one. And that actually ended the year up 17% nearly. So it has, with the exception of 2014, been a pretty good harbinger for the rest of the year. What you do tend to find is that when stock markets top out, is A, there's a lot of volatility precedes it as bears and bulls go into battle for supremacy. And you also get that final euphoric bang straight up, which we haven't, you know, in the classic Sir John Templeton model of bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on scepticism, mature on optimism and die on euphoria. I think there's plenty of scepticism still out there. There's clearly optimism, to be fair, because we're talking about all-time highs in stock markets. Let's not kid ourselves. But are we seeing euphoria?
Simon. That was Russ Mould, Investment Director from AJ Bell there. Are we seeing euphoria? What's happening?
No, I don't think we're really seeing euphoria. Not over here, certainly, in the UK. I would say that you have to separate the UK and the US markets, and we might be seeing a little bit of that unquestioning euphoria type thing. And euphoria, really, when you're talking about it in investing terms and in markets terms, is this element that you find where everyone just thinks the market's just going to keep going up. So it's like you've got to get in, because if you don't get in, it's just going to keep going up and you're going to miss out. And by the time you buy in, you'll have missed out on those gains. It'll be more expensive and it's the only game in town. I'd say we're a long way off that in the UK. In the US, there's definitely a bit more of that kind of mood. But why the big move up? Why did we get the record high this week? Why the shift up? Because Donald Trump gave a speech, gave his address and sounded slightly more normal and less bonkers than usual. Not
it's
quite
sort of said statesmanlike as Russell said. You used to say normal, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when you use the term statesmanlike,
bit much.
Yeah, I think maybe the like bit would probably be the operative word there. Because what we've seen No. You know, whether you are pro or anti-Trump, or whether you just sit on the fence in the middle, you cannot argue that what we have seen since the election was basically the Donald Trump that campaigned to get elected. So there was this sort of misguided belief that I said at the time after the election result that we were going to get a very different Donald Trump when he became president than the one that campaigned. And in the immediate aftermath of the election result, there was a couple of things said and people were like, yeah, no, this is going to happen. This is going to happen. And then we switched straight back to the late night Twitter in capital letters, Donald Trump, that we'd all known to grow and love, you know. And since the inauguration, we've had a lot of that. There's been a huge amount of controversy. There have been suggestions that, you know, are they totally in grip of the White House and everything like that? Then there have been suggestions on the other side that every administration has teething problems. And then this week we had a speech where he put a little bit more flesh on the bones about a number of things. And yes, he did appear to be more statesmanlike in his pronouncements. Now, it's unclear how long he can keep that up. But there were a number of things he said also surrounding infrastructure investment. There's also this belief that he's going to cut taxes for companies and individuals, tax cuts that are going to benefit the middle classes. And there's also this belief that he's going to basically deliver some kind of tax cut that encourages a lot of these American companies that have large amounts of money sat offshore to bring some of it back in, bring it back to the US. The reason why they don't bring it back to the US is they'd be taxed very heavily on it. Some kind of amnesty that slashes that tax rate down either to very little or zero. They bring a load of money back. And the idea is that they will then use this money to invest into their businesses in the US, and that will be great for US productivity and great for US business and great for US workers and put more money in people's pockets. Now, what we've seen before, we've had one of these the last time around, I think it was under George W. Bush. What you actually saw is companies brought a load of money back and then they paid it out to their shareholders in special dividends and share buybacks and things like that. So if companies do that, that's going to hand a ton of money back to shareholders. So investors are buying into these companies on the belief that A, the regulatory environment's going to get easier for them, B, it's going to be easier for them to make money, and C, they're going to get a ton of money back and then they're going to hand it out to the shareholders.
People might question, that could impact in America, but why would that impact here? Why should the FTSE follow where the American indices lead?
So for a start, if you take something called the All World Index, which is basically the global stock market done by the weight of those markets, okay, the US makes up a huge chunk of that. So what happens in the US has a massive influence on what happens in markets around the world. It would be very difficult, for example, for the US stock market to crash and for the UK stock market not to be hit very, very hard. Also, the FTSE 100 is an international index. It looks very much overseas rather than at what's going on in the UK. And also, you've got a scenario where as the pound falls, the FTSE has gone up. So basically, the company's earning in dollars. When they're translated back into pounds and pence, they will look like more. And that effect is still continuing. And also, you do have a scenario where, to be perfectly honest, the FTSE 100 is not overly expensive on a number of long-term valuation measures. The US, on the other hand, that looks pretty expensive.
Lee is the consumer affairs editor. Why should the everyman care about a story like this? Every woman?
Well, you know, it does have an impact on sort of everyday economy and things that are going on and consumer confidence. You know, you see the FTSE 100 go up, people instantly think, oh, you know, things are going okay. But, you know, as Simon rightly points out, it's a very multi sort of national index. A lot of it's down to the dollar strengthening against the pound. And the pound's dropped against so many major currencies. And, you know, that's having a huge impact on people who are going on holiday. It's having a huge impact on imports and exports. So, you know, it's difficult because every man on the street might not be an investor and may, you know, not have much of an interest in this. But it really is a sort of bellwether of what's happening in America. And we all know what happened in the financial crisis. You know, America started to struggle. And then it's such a massive, massive country with such a vast economy. Everything starts to fall around it. And that could have an impact on all sorts of things in your everyday life.
How low do you reckon the pound will sink?
Well, it's a very hard question to answer. I mean, it's already at, you know, crazy loads. If you think back about 10 years ago and you used to be able to get $2 to a pound, it used to be great going to America. You used to get all sorts of treats out there for a good price. But it's very hard to say. I mean, we've had some massive drops just in the aftermath of Brexit, so of the EU referendum vote. So in those sort of weeks, that's where the most of the falls have come. It's going to take something, I don't know, quite drastic for it to start surging again. Maybe if our government actually knew what was going to happen with Brexit, and there wasn't loads of question marks over it, and there was a little bit more confidence in actually what's going on, maybe the pound would start going upwards again. But I think it's also worth pointing out that, you know, the pound has been low in the past. You know, it has been this low against the euro in the past, and it recovered then. It should recover again, you know, in the future. Probably what would happen is then you start seeing the FTSE 100 start to fall, because, as Simon rightly points out, a lot of these companies deal in dollars.
Well, that's it, Simon. I was watching one of your investing shows back in January, and I think it was Holly Black had suggested, one of your colleagues, that the FTSE 100 could go to 9,000. We're hearing commentators this week talking about 10,000. Really?
Well, I think, to be fair to Holly, she probably wasn't personally suggesting it would go to 9,000. She was quoting someone who had said that it could go to 9,000. I mean, it could go to 9,000. That would be a big step up from where we are now. 10,000, it could go to 10,000. If you actually crunch the numbers behind it and work it out over a period of time, i.e. this continues on for another, you know, the market won't rise in a straight line, it will fall back and everything like that. But if the general trend of upward movement continues on for another year or two and earnings go up and various other things, then yeah, you could get there. But trying to call how high it's going to go or time it is notoriously difficult.
If we look at the low point of where the FTSE 100 finished last year, it finished at 5,537 on the 11th of February 2016. And if you'd said this time next year it was going to tip over 7,000, we probably would have gone, probably not. So it's gone up 1,846 points, right? So if it went up that again, and it, you know, as Simon rightly points out, it's going to go up and down and whatever. But if it did follow that trajectory, you know, you are talking about sort of touching 9,000. So who knows?
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio.
Okay, so if London markets following America, will our central bank do the same in raising interest rates, or at least suggesting it like the Fed? Unlikely, reckons a certain Neil Woodford. One of Britain's leading fund managers is warning savers to brace themselves for at least two more years of appalling rates. Mr. Woodford, who manages the $9.3 billion CF Woodford Equity Income Fund, believes the Bank of England will keep interest rates at 0.25% until at least mid-2019 to protect the economy. But firstly, Simon, you met with a great man recently. What did you find out? Why were you hobnobbing with Mr. Woodford?
Well, I should say me and about 15 other people.
Well, you don't have to. You can just say it was you and him. He invited you over to get some advice.
I watched a film.
We went to my house for dinner.
Netflix and chill.
we went to a briefing ahead of the launch of his new fund, where they had invited a selection of investment journalists to come along. Neil came in, gave us a 10-15 minute talk about the fund and what he was doing and the thinking behind it, and then did about sort of 40-45 minutes of answering questions and discussion off the back of it. And it was very interesting. I think as an investor myself, you know, disregarding being a journalist, but as an investor myself, I always find it really interesting to hear from people who, you know, I would put in the sort of bracket of genuinely very good investors, genuinely people who it's worth paying money to manage your money for you. And I would definitely put Neil Woodford in there. And he's got some very interesting views. And one of the things he said was that he didn't see interest rates in the UK going anywhere anytime soon. And that continues something that he's been saying for a number of years now.
Lee, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, Mr. Woodford and his views on interest rates.
Yeah, absolutely. What? Savers, I mean, it's been a heck of a time for savers, hasn't it? And expecting more. Is he just saying this because he wants everyone to invest, though?
Well, no. I mean, there's probably a little element of that to it. But, you know, interest rates, he's saying that they're not going to go up for the next couple of years. You know, so
what was his reasoning?
He's saying that, you know, Bank of England are going to want to protect the average man on the street, you know, because if we start raising rates, people's mortgage payments are going to go up. And that's when you start getting those little cracks in the confidence and, you know, the whole pack of cards could come tumbling down. So, you know, that's why he's kind of making this prediction. We haven't had a rate rise, you know, for a long time. Obviously, we had that one chop last year. But you're right. I mean, savers are having an absolute torrid time. You know, we're having a few fixed rate accounts that are going up and down and whatnot, but even a top rate of sort of 2% isn't going to really be enticing people into save. So yeah, of course, there's a little bit of an element of that. You know, investing can be far simpler than what a lot of people you know, do you think, as Simon rightly puts out in his DIY investor column. But yeah, I mean, people, Neil Woodford's one of those guys, when he says something, a lot of people sit up and take notice, and his views are, you know, really sort of respected by a lot of people in the industry, and people have poured lots of money into his funds, and which he's got a new one coming out.
Well, I do want to ask you, Simon, a little bit more. You mentioned there about his new fund. You got a letter from a reader that said, I've read Neil Woodford is launching a new fund. I already invest in his equity income fund. Should I put some money in the new one too? Now, I thought it was a bit unusual to go for two with the same manager.
Yes, but you have to bear in mind that they are aimed at doing two different things.
Yeah.
This isn't just an exercise in cashing in on the Woodford name and cloning the fund and releasing a new fund to get some more money in from people who don't realise that they're putting money into the same thing. Firstly, just to go back quickly to that interest rates thing. So Woodford's not saying that he necessarily thinks that not raising interest rates is a good idea. What he's saying is realistically that he has always suggested that they will stay lower for longer, because that is what the Bank of England will do. Nothing that the Bank of England has done since 2009 has given any indication that it's going to err on the side of raising interest rates. It has erred massively on the side of caution, as we've discussed before, probably could have got away with raising interest rates, as it turns out. But it's not going to do that. And the only way it would probably do that is if there was some kind of currency crisis and it needed to defend the currency. And even then, it would try to avoid doing it at all costs. So he's saying, don't think that they're going to be raising interest rates. So why are they launching an income fund? Well, because of what I just said. Basically, it is a fund that targets dividends, the dividends that companies pay out, and delivers income to people. So you can either take that income from those dividends and you can reinvest that income to build up your wealth over time. And actually, if you look at the total return from the stock market over the years, most of that comes from dividends and dividends being compounded. Or you can take that income and you can spend it. So, for example, for people who are living off a pot of money, you might be a pensioner who has retired with a defined contribution pension, and thanks to the new pension freedom rules, you've kept that invested and you're drawing on the dividends from your investments in order to provide you with money to live on. That income is a very important thing. And there is a demand, a huge demand from people for something that can deliver income. Now, that comes in a number of different ways. It comes in the way that if somebody releases a savings account that pays 2%, which is like, whoa, market beating, everyone goes completely crazy for it and rushes in and tries to pile all their money into it. It also comes in a way where we get people being lured into investments that may not potentially be the most sensible, such as airport parking spaces, which promise to deliver a 10 or 12% a year return. But it also comes from the stock market. And what Woodford is saying is, I'm going to launch this new fund different to my old fund. So his old fund is basically an equity income fund, but it invests in a sizable number of companies, and it invests in some companies that don't pay a dividend. So whilst a lot of them are dividend paying companies, some of them don't pay a dividend, and some of them are quite exciting new and young companies. He's got a big interest in these companies that are spun out of sort of that's health technology, kind of spun out of universities and things like that. Now, this new fund isn't going to be invested in those things that don't pay a dividend. It is going to basically, if you put a pound in at launch, it's going to target paying you 5p's worth of income in next year. So basically kind of a year's time. That would represent 5% on the money that you put in. Now, you have to bear in mind that that might not represent a 5% yield at the time, because the price of the fund would go up or down. But that means that in this fund, he's going to have to target shares that deliver, he's going to have to target some shares that pay more than 5% in order to get that 5% average, because he's going to have some that pay less than it. So that fund's going to try and pay out a higher dividend yield than the stock market as a whole, which pays out just under 4% at the moment. So it's going to be less aggressive than the other fund, which goes for some companies that don't pay dividends. It's going to invest in less early stage companies. It's still going to invest in some small companies, not just big companies. And he explained that what he's looking for in companies, and it will invest in some overseas companies as well. What he said he's looking for is companies with good cash flow. So that means that they've got money coming in, basically, from their activities, that have strong balance sheets, so they are in good financial shape, so that those dividends look safe, because they can afford to pay the dividend from the cash that they have coming in, rather than paying it from reserves or selling off bits of the business. They're not over-promising. that they've got good balance sheets, so they're safe, they're stable, they're not suddenly going to go bust, and also that he thinks are at a good price. And he said that might be because they're cheap, you know, they look cheap, and other people just don't like them because they're unloved. It might be that other people think that they look expensive, but he thinks that he has spotted a reason why actually the market is still undervaluing them. Or it might be that they look average. And the one thing that it did come across from the briefing was that he's pretty steely, and he's obviously a fund manager at the top of his game, mm-hmm. but he's also quite a humble guy. And you read this all the time when you read interviews, you know, with him, people say that. It's genuinely true, you know, beyond that sort of steeliness and the fact that obviously he is a fund manager at the top of his game. There is quite a bit of humility there. But he did say that, you know, the one thing that he thinks that he can do well is pick stocks for investors. He said there's lots of other things that he can't do well, and there's lots of other things that he wouldn't pretend to do well, you know, and there's reasons why he wouldn't go off and open a fund that invested in emerging markets or something else that he was managing. Because he said, I don't know about that stuff. But he said he does know about this stuff. And to be fair, if you look at his track record, he does. So it's bound to get a ton of money flowing into it from investors, basically.
Have you ever met Warren Buffett?
No, but he's more than welcome to invite me
to
a small briefing for journalists.
He can come on the investing show as well. Do get in contact at editor. But the reason I mention that, because didn't he say that he's probably only met 10 people in his life that can successfully pick stocks? Has he met Neil Woodford?
He did say that, didn't he? So he's not talking about me, because no. I've never met him. But then
you'd
that
be number 11.
But that might mean that he's not talking about me, because I've never met him. So
I like your thinking there,
yeah,
Simon.
Exactly. He made this point. So, right, I don't know whether Warren Buffett has ever met Neil Woodford. There's a great question, isn't there? If I get invited along to something
next
again
time,
with Neil Woodford, or in the unlikely event that I end up having lunch with Warren Buffett, I will ask that question.
Do.
But I would say that I'm not sure whether Warren Buffett was speaking exactly, as in a literally, I've only met 10 people, I've been counting them, I've got a book, I've written them down, and if I meet number 11, next time I tell you this, I'll tell you 11. Or whether he was saying, you know, I've only met 10 people, which, you know, he was just sort of using a casual grouping. I think that if Warren Buffett was grilled about, you know, okay, how about this guy? Can he do it? How about this guy? Can he do it? How about this woman? Can she do it? How about this woman? Can she do it? I think if he was grilled about that, he would put Neil Woodford in the box that says, yes, actually, he can. And he does have the kind of track record that says he can.
The reason that as well I mention this is because Warren Buffett makes your This Is Money pages as well. Now, he's some rather choice comments about hedge fund managers. They charge too much, they can't beat the market, and actually you'd be better off sticking with a bog standard tracker fund. Now, he reckons it's cost rich folk around about £80 billion over the last decade, and so confident was he in his theory, he even made a £400,000 bet 9 years ago that a fund tracking the S&P 500 index would outperform hedge funds. So it's that age-old debate, isn't it? Active versus passive. But first of all, what's a hedge fund? Is it different to any other actively managed fund?
Well, and only that it's topiary-based.
Yeah, okay, great.
It's basically, a hedge fund is a fund where you're essentially hedging. You can go long, which is what we traditionally think of as investing when you buy something, or you can go short, which means that you are effectively selling something. And what you're doing is you're hedging your bets. So forget all this industry jargon and everything else. Everybody understands the term hedging your bets. What hedging your bets means is that you are not fully exposing yourself to the prospect of something going in the direction that you don't think it's going to go in. Hedge funds have been around for a long, long time, but they've been exceptionally popular over the last 20 years. And there's a big industry that has grown up around it. And some of these funds are involved in picking the best companies, or picking companies that they think will do well and the companies that they don't think will do well, looking at the sort of fundamental basics of it, you know, the numbers, the actual reality of the company. Some of them are basically just extremely complicated maths, just algorithms, computer programs, things where basically you've got some guy who's a maths and physics genius who in another lifetime would have been working out ways to send people into space or build amazing things, and instead they got sucked up by the financial industry, and now they sit in a room with a computer trying to work out if that does that and then 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 that happens to that, but that doesn't do that, then we could exploit that and make this bit of money here, and if we channel a huge amount of money through it, then that will mean a big this will make a profit for us. Anyway, that seems like an awful lot of effort to get what actually is a fairly rubbish return if you look at how well hedge funds have done over the last sort of 5 years. And yeah, Mr. Buffett made this bet and he is almost certainly going to win this bet.
This is Money in partnership with NS&I. Have any premium bond prizes you win paid directly into your bank account.
Warm welcome, I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the financial website of the year. This is Money. Are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS9. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lauber and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. Now, next week, Chancellor Philip Hammond gets to deliver his first and last spring budget. Don't worry, he's not got the sack that I know of. It's being swapped over with the autumn statement, so we get an autumn budget and a smaller spring statement, something to do with having more time for tax changes, but I digress. Next week, we confront the implications of the Brexit vote. We focus on government borrowing, business rates, and just how reliant our economy is on us going out and buying stuff. So, Lee, get out your crystal ball, please. Tell us, what do you expect him to say? Do you expect many changes to be made? Does he have the money to play with?
I think all of those answers are no, no, no. I don't know what's going to happen. But it's going to be, I think, quite a quiet one. There's a lot going on, bubbling in the background, you know, with Article 50 and all of the conversations surrounding that. The one thing I reckon that will be a hot topic and will be mentioned quite a lot is a plan for social care. Now, that's been massive in the last couple of months with the talks of council tax rises, and some council tax rises going above and beyond 4%, which is the maximum that councils can up their yearly tax by. So I think it's going to be a little bit of that and some stuff about the NHS. And the thing is, all of these sort of departments and all the councils are pretty cash strapped. All I beg and hope is that there's not another ISA announced or some sort of ISA product, you know, that's going to make things even more complicated. But my hunch is that this is going to be a pretty damp squib affair.
Well, is there a lot he can say with Article 50 expected to be triggered, well, within 2 weeks, we're thinking?
This is it. I mean, what, these people must be working pretty hard to be having to deal with all of this stuff. I mean, are they going to sleep? I mean, that makes me a bit worried about some of these decisions that are being made. I mean, it's a lot.
Who's got time for another ISA? Yeah. We've got Brexit
exactly
to think about.
I mean, I know, you know, he's moving the budget around, so there's going to only be one budget instead of this budget and this autumn statement, which has been a bit of a pain, to be honest with you, the last couple of years, you know, because
it's
that autumn statement
it's got so big.
So, like, I'm glad he's done that, but it's kind of like maybe he should have delayed this one by a little bit, because there's just so much going on. It's crazy. You could be working, literally, maybe they are actually earning, you know, their wage, politicians at the moment. Maybe they're actually making decisions and doing things, because imagine having to deal with all that.
Doing it, surely.
But imagine all of these decisions and things that are going on. And that's why my hunch is that this budget's going to be a little bit, you know, of a lackluster affair. I can't imagine there's going to be many rabbits being pulled out of the hat.
He's not the sort of chancellor either, no, is he, Philip Hammond, compared to George Osborne?
Exactly. Osborne was a bit of a showboater in terms of a chancellor, I would say. You know, sometimes I sometimes had this vision of him. It's sort of like the week of the budget, he's thinking, ooh, he's in a bar, you know, he's just on the back of a sort of cigarette box type thing. Oh, this would be a good idea, but another ISA. Or how about we launch an NS&I product for pensioners? You know, some of these things, they just felt very, like, snatched at. Do you know what I mean? It was almost
headline
like, what
grabbing.
What can I do to... Exactly, it was headline grabbing. There hasn't been much of that in the run-up yet, but they've had other things to think about. So, I don't know. I think this is going to be... I'm going to put a bet on this. This is going to be one of the shortest budgets ever.
Well, interestingly, I think the shortest was Disraeli at 45 minutes.
I think I'm definitely putting this bet on. If this time next week, I'm retired in the Bahamas, you'll know what I did.
Just give us a sum up, though. I mean, we've spoken about the pound form, we've spoken about the FTSE. We will get sort of an idea as we prepare to push that big red Article 50 button as to how the economy's doing.
Yeah.
Give us your take.
Well, Georgia, how long have we been talking about this now? Since Brexit, right? Since the EU referendum, since that memorable morning when you and I were all set here. Week in, week out, we've been like, you know, what has the effect of that decision and EU referendum had? You know, okay, the pound's dropped and the markets are performing well. But other than that, it's all been a little bit sort of, I don't know the best word to say, it's almost a bit floaty. We're all sort of just sort of floating. We don't quite know who's going to be the hardest hit, what's really, you know, happening. We should get a clear indication of that, I'm going to guess, in the next month. So perhaps this time next month, we're going to have a lot more answers to questions than what we have at the moment. But it's such an interesting time in the world of politics and being a journalist in a financial newsroom, because we just don't know what's going to happen from one day to the next. And honestly, in budgets gone by, we've always had a little bit of an inclination of what, you know, sort of going to happen. There's always a couple of leaks. Somehow these stories get leaked. This time round, hasn't been a lot of that. And maybe you're right. Maybe it is because Hammond's a little bit more playing his cards closer to his chest. And maybe he will pull out an ace. Who knows?
Well, maybe it's because there isn't one.
Well, maybe there's not. Exactly.
Well, we're just all getting excited for a new ISA. Now, it's interesting you mentioned that, Lee, because a budget offering from the previous Chancellor, George Osborne, comes into force this April, or does it? The lifetime ISA, or the LISA, for first-time buyers under 40, so they can save through the house or retirement with a hefty government top-up. It's not without its catches, though. Firstly, let's hear from Head of Advice at Unbiased, Claire Walsh.
A lifetime ISA is all about trying to encourage people to get on the property ladder. So it's aimed at younger people. You've got to be under 40 when you start contributing to it. You can put in up to £4,000 each year. And the real incentive with the lifetime ISA is that the government will match your savings. They'll put in an extra £1,000. Now, the kind of catch here is what you use the money for. So lifetime ISA is designed for buying a property. You've got to be a first-time buyer, so it's your first property, and you only get that added government bonus when you cash out to buy a property. If you don't use the money to buy a property, you can keep the money and draw it out at retirement, but you've got to be over 60 when you access it. And if you don't, if you want to do anything else with it, if you want to draw it out before age 60 and not buy a property with it, then you don't get the government bonus, the 25% government bonus, and you also don't get, you know, there's a 5% penalty, so you lose 5% of the money you've put in.
Now, whether you like the sound of that or not, there is a bit of a catch, because you might not actually be able to get your hands on one anyway. Rather embarrassingly, Treasury officials have told your sister paper, Money Mail, that not a single firm is on track to launch it in April. Lee, what on earth?
ISAs used to be such a good little product, you know, just like your cash ISA, your stocks and shares ISA. It was a way to shield against the tax man, your interest. It's just got so complicated, and I don't know what this is all, you know, all about. It's just crazy. But providers are saying they've not had time. They've not had time to be able to offer these products, and I'm not surprised.
What do you mean time? What do they need? What's the problem with it?
There's a lot of red tape. It's not as simple as... Think about how complicated that just was, how he was explaining that, and how all of these little caveats work. It's not actually going to be that easy for providers just to go, oh, right, lifetime ISA, let's launch that next week. Because it's not a simple product. There's a lot of elements to it. There's a lot of, in the banks, you know, in building societies, they have to see what's going to be flowing in, what's going to be flowing out, and they've got all of their other products to deal with. I actually met with head of a savings provider last week, and we were talking about just a cash ISA, and he was saying that cash ISA rates are lower than other rates, so your easy access and your fixed cash ISA, your fixed standard rates, because there's so much paperwork involved with an ISA. So because of that paperwork, they don't offer as good rates. Now, can you imagine what the paperwork is going to be on this lifetime ISA? It must be absolutely crazy. And, you know, banks and building sites are already having to deal with, you know, these other ISAs and merging it in from the other one that you launch. Oh, it's just... It's
big
crazy.
Fan then, Lee, yeah?
I am not a fan, Georgie. I think that saving for a house and having a pension are two very different things, and whether this sticks around or not, I don't know. I don't want to downplay it and be too negative on it, but it is rubbish.
So all right.
Actually, yeah,
it's all right. You can't get one anyway. So
maybe
don't,
Simon's got a different view.
Don't worry about it, Simon. Do you have a different view?
No, I agree with actually a lot of that. One of the reasons why this is so difficult for banks to set up is it might be called a lifetime ISA, but it is completely different to a normal ISA. You know, this 25% bonus thing and everything like that. It's all completely different. It's kind of like a cross between the way an ISA works and the way a pension works. And also, I think that there is this element where, in theory, this looked like quite a good idea. And if you have taken all of the money that your company will put into your pension each year, put the maximum amount you can to get the maximum amount from your company, and you are under 40, then actually this might be worth you doing. But it's combining two separate things, and it's combining two things that don't really work together, because basically saving money for a house deposit, if you're planning on buying it, generally people are planning on buying a house within the next 5 years if they're doing that, is a short-term thing. And for short-term things, you shouldn't really be investing that money, because when you go to crack into that pot to get your money for your deposit, you might find out that if the market has fallen, that you've got less in there than you put in, or less than you expect, or less than you need. Investing for retirement, however, is a long-term game, and you can afford to look over those short-term fluctuations and problems. So yes, you do want to be investing that in the stock market. So what you're going to get in this scenario is you're going to get, and we already know this, we've seen this from what people do with their cash and their investing ISAs, is way more people go for cash because they see it as safe. They think investing is too much of a gamble. So you'll get loads of people investing money, that putting money that they should be investing for retirement into a savings account and getting a subpar return on it. Or at the other end of the scale, you're going to get people who should be putting money into a savings account for their house, putting money into an investing account because they think they'll make more money quickly, and then all of a sudden the market falls and they don't get it. And so I'm not really that surprised that banks and building societies aren't overly enamoured with this. What you do have is a couple of investing firms who are going to be opening up. I think Nutmeg are and Hargreaves Lansdown are, but I think that's the only two. And it's much more of a winner if you're an investing platform. This is a much better idea for you. But no, it's not set the world on fire, and it probably sounded like a good idea, because when you ask people, why aren't you saving for your pension? They go, well, because I can't even save any money for a house. And so it was like, oh, why don't we put these two things together? Well, there's an idea.
Back in the matchbox, yeah.
Yeah. Hang on a minute. Okay, I've run out of places to write how this is going to work because my beer mat is too small. No worries. I'll just announce that and we'll work that stuff out later. What it looks like happened. And there is the suggestion that this could end up dead in the water. I mean, Money Mill had a piece written for them by, you know, one of the Treasury ministers. He said, no, this is a good plan. This is a good plan. You know, this is going to help people. But there is definitely the suspicion the finance industry that this one's going to end up being shelved.
Aren't we a little bit close to the wire, though?
Well,
shelved.
What's going
to
happen if you put your money into a lifetime ISA and then we just junk this idea? I mean, who knows? I mean, there is this thing where it's like, right, okay, you put your money in, and you can buy your first house. If you're not buying your first house, you're going to get massively penalised for taking your money out. But you can only get this bonus up to a certain point. And also with this thing, if you use this to put the money in that you would otherwise be putting into your work pension, your employer won't be contributing to it in the same way they would your work pension. And you will be missing out on one of the most important bits of your work pension, which for many people is that their employer will match what they put in. And that has a quite powerful effect. And also the tax relief is better on a pension. If you're a higher rate taxpayer. So yeah, I can't see this one lasting, to be honest.
I'm not a huge fan.
It must be quite embarrassing actually, because these products are meant to be launching next week.
Yeah.
Lloyds, Santander, Nationwide, Yorkshire Building Society, all saying they have no plans to launch one whatsoever this year. Right, so that's this year. And then Barclays, HSBC, RBS and Skipton all said, well, we're waiting for the final rules from the FCA. So I don't see, you know, we're a month away and the FCA hasn't given them the rules of how to...
Imagine a football match, right? imagine a game, a sporting occasion where they were about to kick off and nobody was quite sure of the rules. Imagine that. You couldn't imagine that happening, could you? Oh, hang on a minute. Rugby game. Yeah, but it would be... It's
very
exactly
topical,
like
Simon.
That.
Very
you
topical.
Know that bit where the England rugby team stood there and went... we don't know what to do. This is a lot like it looks like the financial industry are doing.
Very, very true. Okay, well, something, though, that will definitely, I'm sure, be coming in soon and probably far less popular than the LISA, though doubtless more robustly implemented, and that's change to probate fees. Now, the government is pushing ahead with what's being called a stealth tax, despite a consultation showing just 2% were in favour. Now, the new system could see some estates paying fees as much as £20,000. So what exactly is probate? Personal finance expert Rachel Springall explains.
Basically, they're a fee at the end of paying off an estate. So when someone passes away, the whole estate then gets assessed, and the money from which obviously goes to the next beneficiaries. Now, there's a fee in that process, and that is the probate fee. So the fact that they're going to skyrocket is a terrible thing for those with a high net worth estates, especially if the elderly are expected to live a little bit longer and the estate is growing in wealth. That means they could be paying as much as £20,000. They've said the fees are necessary to maintain an accessible, world-leading justice system, which puts the needs of victims and vulnerable people first. But others are saying they're basically taxing the wealthy.
Simon, what's going on here?
Well, I can explain a bit about this because I have had the misfortune of being involved in probate twice in the last 3 years, once for my dad and once for my grandmother.
I'm sorry.
And basically, probate is the process that you go through when someone dies. So in their will, they say who they want their money to go to. And what you have to do is go through the process of probate. And that you have to do even when there is no inheritance tax to pay. So it might be, for example, that a husband or a wife has left everything to their spouse. So you know there's going to be no inheritance tax because that is tax-free. Or it might be that an estate is below the inheritance tax threshold. Yet, even though that is the case, you still have to gather together all the information, write to all the banks and building societies and, you know, investment companies and things like that, get it all together, fill in two long, complicated forms. There's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. It is laborious. You can do it yourself. You don't need to pay someone to do it for you, but it does take quite a lot of time if you have other things that you need to do in your life. And at the end of all that, after you've done all the legwork, you fill in another form that says where you would like to basically take these things to. So you send off your probate forms, your two forms, your original copy of the will, three copies of the will, along with the original copy of the will, an original death certificate, and a cheque for the probate fees. And the probate fees basically pay for a rubber stamping exercise. You go along to the probate registry, someone checks through your documents, says yep, and then they give you this thing called a grant of representation, which is what you need to take to the bank, building society or other company in order to basically access those assets that have been left to generally a relative. Mm. Okay, so you can't get at that money if it's more than £5,000 in a savings account or something like that, or you can't get at the property if it's been owned in a sole name or as tenants in common unless you've got that piece of paper. But that probate fee, there's not really a lot of work going into this at the probate registry. It is literally a fee for a very simple service. And it was £215, which, you know, to be honest, seems a little bit steep. The executor pays it, basically. So it gets paid out of the estate. The executor pays it. It seems a little bit steep, but you think, yeah, well, you know, fair enough. It's probably a bit more work involved than you think. However, the government Ministry of Justice cooked up a plan to change these probate fees, but to change them quite substantially. So instead of being £215 for all estates above £5,000, the lower level was going to go up to £50,000, which is good, but it did say in there that it just reflects the big rise in asset prices since 1999 when this fee was introduced. But above that, basically, the fees are going to absolutely rocket. So at the lowest level, they'd go up to £300, because now it's a fixed fee, but instead they want to grade it on the estate. So at the lowest level, it would go up 40% to £300. But then it starts going up even more. For estates between £300,000 and £500,000, it goes up to £1,000, which is a 365% rise in the fee. For estates worth more than £500,000 and up to £1,000,000, it goes up to £4,000, which is a 1,760% rise in the fee. And then at the highest level, for estates worth more than £2 million, it goes up to £20,000, a 9,202% rise. Now, you might think that it's fair that rich people pay more, okay? That is one of the principles of fair taxation. Except, we already have a tax where richer people pay more on death, and it's called inheritance tax. And the clue is that it's called inheritance tax, whereas this is a fee for a service. And is it ever okay to whack up the fee for a service from £215 to £1,000 or £4,000 or £20,000? Can you imagine if a bank did this?
Yeah.
If it said, yeah, you know that thing we were charging you £215 for? Still exactly the same thing. It's going to be £4,000 now. Can you imagine the uproar? Yet this has basically been brought in by the Ministry of Justice because it says it has admitted it's to subsidise the rest of the court service.
Why don't they just change it and call it a tax?
Well,
a probate
that's what
tax.
Rankles with me. Yeah. Is what rankles with me is that this is they quietly raised this thing. Loads of people aren't going to notice this, okay? And it's only going to hit people in a certain scenario, but they're not going to be able to do anything about it because mm-hmm. you can't get that money without a grant of representation. And what they have done is they have taken a fee and turned it into a tax. And disregarding whether you think that this should be graded or whatever with, you know, the value of an estate, do we think that it is okay to be in a scenario where government departments can take a simple fee for a service and just randomly turn it into another tax? In my mind, that's not okay.
No, nor I, Lee.
It's a very sort of strange thing for a sort of conservative government to do. That was the first thing I thought when I saw this change.
But it's not a tax.
It's not.
It's a fee, Lee. It's
on,
okay.
Come on, it's a tax. And what really rams me with this is that they had a consultation. So a lot of these things have consultations. Now, 2% of people were in favour for it. Now, I know a lot of people probably is skewed by people that this is going to affect the most, I would guess. But just what was the point? You know, you don't listen to anyone. So 98% of people thought this was a bad idea. What other consultations have there been where it's almost like, what was the point of you getting involved?
Well, that is a really good point. What is the point in consultations?
Well, I think to be fair, okay, so there were two questions in the consultation. One was, did the respondents agree with the fees that they were proposing, of which only 2% agreed? Okay, so they ignored 98%. But there was a question about whether people thought that the fees should be graded in with estates, so they should be banded. They should go from a fixed fee to a sliding scale. And more people did agree with that. There was a whacking great 8% who said they thought that was a good idea. So what?
Just giving the people what they want.
I spoke to someone from the Ministry of Justice yesterday. I said, why did you completely ignore the consultation? They told me they didn't ignore the consultation, that they took the consultation on board. What do you say to when you ask someone the question of when you asked people, do you think this is a good idea? And only 8% of them said yes. And then you just did it anyway. And I think it's also very important to note that if you look through the list of respondents of that consultation, they are basically mainly legal experts. It's not just like Miss Joe Schmo on the street who didn't want to pay out more money. It was legal experts, people who actually know what they're talking about.
Well, surely you ask them, what is the overriding thing to democracy, basically? What is more important than 92%
of people? I try to
pin
them down to an answer of, so what's this paying for? What does this service involve? Ah, when they said probate. Blah, blah, blah. I said, yeah, but the executor does all the legwork, don't they? Oh, yeah, but you know, I said it's a rubber stamping. Well, it's not just a rubber stamping exercise. I said, how much time do you think it takes? Would you be able to couldn't put any time on it, anything like that. Basically, it is a massive racket. And what's going to happen is it's going to get pushed through. People are going to do a bit of moaning about it. Half of our readers are going to read it and go, oh, yeah, whatever, rich people being charged more. But actually, this goes against all principles of how you should do stuff, and this is not the kind of thing we should be allowing to happen.
I thought it was parking fines and problems that were going to cause you the problems, Simon. I was totally wrong. You've been reporting how many councils are rejecting parking ticket appeals, even when people have legitimate claims. Now it's raking in millions for local government. Simon, hit us with it very quickly. What's this about?
Councils and parking. I mean, this is, we talk about making a rod for your own back here.
Is this Islington or is this other ones?
No, no. Well, Islington is one of the worst, basically. I mean, what we've seen over the last decade or more is the spread of the controlled parking zone. And the problem is once you put in parking restrictions in one place, you have to put it in the neighbouring place because all the people who would have parked in the first place park in the second place. And councils rake in a load of money from it. And theoretically, they are not allowed to use that money for general funding, okay? Mm-hmm. But the way they get around this is, we all know, they use that money to pay for stuff, and then the money that they would have otherwise used to pay for that stuff, they just put elsewhere. And you basically, if you appeal your parking ticket, if you have a decent reason for appealing it, you know, as in you were wrong in getting it, or you think you've spotted a little loophole, you actually have a pretty strong chance of winning. But lots of councils basically turn down the appeals. And the suspicion is they basically turn down the appeals because they think people won't take them any further and they'll just pay up. But then when people go to the Ombudsman, they do actually overwhelmingly tend to win. And not Islington Council, but Haringey Council, many years ago, in Haringey, there's places where you're meant to park with two wheels on the pavement. They mark the bays out. Parked on a single yellow line on a Sunday behind those bays, and I put two wheels on the pavement because otherwise I would have been blocking the road. And on a single yellow line, you're allowed to park on a Sunday. Came back to the car, got a parking ticket, and the reason ringed is for having two wheels on the pavement, which is just ludicrous. Wrote to the council, said, this is crazy, I shouldn't have got this. They refused to rescind it. I had photos, I had everything. They'd got there, and actually, I was all right because not only had I done the sensible thing and so I was appealing to their better judgment, but they'd put one of their signs the wrong way around. So the sign was telling you to park with two wheels on the pavement if you were outside the bay rather than in it. And I said, look, all of this and your signs the wrong way around. Still refused to do it. I went all the way to the Ombudsman, had a date to go to the Ombudsman. Lo and behold, just before I meant to go to the Ombudsman, get a letter saying, actually, you've won by default because the council hasn't bothered to enter any evidence. Now, that council... Awful. I wrote to them letters that went backwards and forwards, everything else like that. Must have been like at least five letters on their part. That would have taken them time. All the time it took me, all of that stuff.
You should bill them for
how
much time.
You know, I wasted time, they wasted time for something that clearly should never have been issued. And then lo and behold, they don't put any evidence in. And that is what's happening all over the show.
I don't know about you getting irate. I'm irate at listening to you.
Yeah,
going
through the roof here.
Well, I tell you what. Finally, we're going to for our final story. I wasn't particularly happy about this, but maybe I've slightly read this a little bit wrong. So forgive me, Range Rover. But the veil was finally lifted on their new Velar. Velar. Simon, help me out there.
Velar.
Whatever. The fourth member of its luxury 4x4 family. Now, it comes in at just under £45,000. It is the ultimate Chelsea tractor. It's even apparently been designed for women in mind. Now, it offers a vegetarian option. Yeah, you heard that right. Which replaces the luxury leather seats with coverings made from recycled plastic bottles, presumably from yoga classes. But before I ask you about what is a woman's car, at least it wasn't pink. And I was actually have to say, I was really surprised reading this article about the fanfare, Lee, around, I don't know, what would you call it? A car catwalk? Do a nice 3-point turn at the end before speeding off? I mean, there were celebs everywhere. It was an event.
Well, look,
is this normal?
When you've got a sexy car brand, George,
it was only 45 grand. It's not like a 451 that Simon talks about.
It's one of these brands that, you know, a lot of celebrities buy into. You see a lot of people sort of pictured in their Range Rovers. And yeah, it was in Kensington, very salubrious. And they had lots of celebrities there and their brand ambassadors to run the rule over their new female-friendly car.
Don't even get me started.
No, I'm sorry. I'm just winding you up.
I know you are.
But no, a lot of cars do. I mean, there's always fanfare. You've got all sorts of motor shows around the world. People love cars and they want to see it, you know, launched in such a manner that it's almost like a catwalk.
Yeah,
it is almost like a catwalk. And it was launched at the Design Museum in Kensington and there was lots of celebrities there admiring it.
All right, so what makes it a woman's car and why is it so good?
Nothing makes it a woman's car, Georgie. Oh. Every car is for male or female, and if you tell me otherwise, I don't believe you.
Surely it says in your article somewhere that it is slightly designed for women in mind. Slightly designed.
I suppose, yes. Mums, parents. You know.
Well, it's a Chelsea tractor, of course. Who else drives these around the rough roads of Kensington?
Okay, yeah, so there is an element of that. So it fits into the Range Rover range between the Evoque and the Range Rover Sport to fill the white space, Range Rover said. You obviously were well aware of this white space.
No,
it competes with a number of cars.
My eyes go crossed and glazed.
Porsche Macan, Jaguar F-Pace, Audi Q5, very popular cars. And Ray Massey, our reporter, you know, did ask the Land Rover guys, you know, did you design it with women in mind? And they said, yeah, well, we are always thinking about women when we're designing cars because they're very influential in the buying process. And, you know, I often think when I hear things like that, it is a bit sort of casual sexism, you know, like, oh, you designed it with women in mind. It's like, well, it's a car. Like, you know, they both, women and men when driving cars, both use their arms, hands and feet and eyes, hopefully. But actually, you know, there is an element where, and it is still true, that basically it does tend to be the mum that does the school run more often than the dad and things like that. So maybe sometimes you get some features that are there to help them. So the classic one that was always wheeled out by the motor industry was this thing where basically instead of having to open the boot, you wave your foot under the back of the car. Ooh. And that helped people when they were doing the shopping. And it used to be, when this first came out, a number of car manufacturers, it was said, oh, yeah, and this will help mums, as if mums are the only people who carry the shopping. So, there was that element. I mean, who knows? You know, I think that if I think about the male and female attitude to cars, I tend to think of men and women who like cars tend to like the same cars. And men and women who aren't particularly interested in cars tend to like the same cars as well. So is there a big difference? I don't know. What's interesting is actually this sort of leather, this non-leather seat option here, where actually if you buy luxury cars, you pretty much have to end up with leather seats. Mm. And what they've said is, well, that's not fair on people who might have some ethical objection to leather. So they have offered these what's been called vegetarian seats, although I wouldn't recommend eating them.
Plastic bottles. Thank you so much, Editor Simon Lambert, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. Premium bonds, making people smile for 60 years.